So today's talk is given by Professor Graham Clark of the School of Geography at the University of Leeds. Graham's an ex-head of department there and is perhaps more importantly also university staff cricket vice-captain. His current research interests, amongst cricket and other things, includes GIS, urban services, retail and business geography, urban modelling, and also continuing professional education. So any visitors to our opening seminar, which was also hosted jointly with the Human Geography Research Group, if anyone came to that, will notice some common interest there with the speaker on that date, which was Sir Alan Wilson, who in fact Graham worked with a few years ago, the 1980s and beyond, has a long history with. Today's talk, however, is concerned with the specific area of microsimulation, which without further ado, I'll hand over to Graham to illuminate upon. Graham.
Thanks very much, Alan. Thank you very much for inviting me along today. It's great so many of you here at 4 o'clock on a Friday when the pub is so, I'm sure, calling you. And those who've come from Northern Ireland, I'm particularly pleased that you've travelled this all this way to hear this. So thank you for coming along today. Thank you as well, Neil, for inviting me. What I thought to do is talk about microsimulation, but I'm going to try and do it in a non-technical way. Just because I think, A, it's Friday at 4 o'clock. B, I think I want to really just try and get home over the applications, the use that I've been involved with, certainly probably over about a 10-year period with various colleagues at the University of Leeds. And so basically want to give you a flavour for how it's been used. But of course, to do that, I need to talk a little bit about methodology and a little bit about the technique as we go through. There are technical papers. If anybody is interested in the technical detail, the mathematical programmes and so on, then I can send those paper details to you. But I'm really going to try and avoid that on a Friday afternoon today. So what I want to get through is I want to say a little bit about microsimulation, for those of you who haven't come across this terminology before. A little bit, first of all, about its advantages. And then I'm going to do, hopefully, those advantages through a number of applications. So I'm going to talk about maybe how it could be used in social-based policy. So looking at the impacts of tax changes, that kind of thing. Area-based policy, and perhaps I can make some comparisons with more traditional area-based kind of regional policy analysis, things that maybe that you come across like input-output modelling techniques in econometrics and so on, and make just some comparisons with that, because obviously it's at the completely opposite end of that macro kind of work. And then I want to talk, mainly for Jamie, a little bit about health and retail, just a bit of a service example as well, bringing in some of our work in health and retail. I'm really a retail geographer. That's my 75%. That's my bread and butter. So I do all this microsimulation as an extra kind of technique-based in service analysis in particular. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the research agenda, just briefly at the end, some of the things we're working on now, some of the issues that microsimulation raises, some of the problems, dare I say, that it raises, some of the problems, I'm sure, are issues that you'll think of as I go through, just in terms of the research agenda and some recent papers that we've done and working on. So, what is it, first of all? Microsimulation, really, as the name suggests, is about two parts, the micro bit and the simulation bit. So the first thing is trying to get a micro database, a database of households or individuals. And a database that, for geography purposes, maybe covers the whole city or region. So if we take Edinburgh, for example, we know quite a little, well, quite a lot about Edinburgh from the census. We may also know surveys. We may have surveys of different individuals or households in Edinburgh, probably not in Edinburgh, but in Scotland, per se. What we're trying to do, then, is to say, can we build for Edinburgh a database of every household in the city and what it might look like? Okay. So you see, it's quite an ambitious aim, if you like. But if I can do that, then it's very powerful for all sorts of what-ifs that, that we might be able to do on that data set. So one way of looking at it is to say we would love to get the individual census records that's going, I'm sure, just arrived on my doorstep down in England. The census has just arrived for 2011. If only we could get, as researchers, we could get a hold of all those individual census records. Well, in a sense, microsimulation is almost trying to recreate that for the applications, the big applications that I'm going to talk about today. So if we can do that, obviously what we might want to do is estimate missing data. So data sets that we don't have simulated. Again, I'll come back to some examples as we'll see this. Once I've got my micro database, then obviously I can do all sorts of simulations. I can forecast, update it. I can run it through what-if scenarios. And particularly, as you'll see today, I can perhaps link to other models. You've had a talk on GWR, geographically weighted regression recently, spatial interaction modeling. So we can link it to those individuals, link to those more mesoscale models. Now, how do we do this? Well, microsimulation literature, talk about Sir Alan Wilson. You could argue that he, in about 1976, wrote the first paper on spatial microsimulation whilst he was at Leeds, arguing for building individual level data sets as opposed to mesoscale models. And from then onwards, we've had a research tradition at Leeds in generating these data sets. And I guess the old traditional way of doing it was number one. And basically what we would do is start with any household in Edinburgh. So just think of maybe your own household. Okay. Given that its location, then we would try to say, okay, what's the probability that that household is a certain age group? What's the probability it has a certain social class? What's the probability that the person's in there working in a certain industry? What's the probability that they have a certain ethnic group? And so you start with the household located and you try and build up the attributes of that household one by one. Okay? Based on all the census, different census tables that you can bring together. And there were techniques like iterative proportional fitting, which allowed you to try and work out the conditional probabilities of a house having age, sex, social class, etc. So that's how we try to do it. Once you've then got the probabilities, basically you'd run a sort of Monte Carlo simulation, sampling, to say, okay, it's 60% chance this household is white as opposed to non-white. A random number for that household gives you 35. It falls within the 0 to 60 band, therefore that house is classified as white. Then you move on to the next variable and the next variable. And that's how they built it up. So that when you've got this estimate of a whole series of households in this part of Edinburgh, then you check to make sure you've got the totals right. So did it all add up? Had I got all the right number of white houses, the right number of age groups, and so on? If you haven't, you simulated it wrong, back to the drawing board, okay, until you got it right. So that was very good, in the sense that it was very strong geography, because you started with a household in a particular location. But those interdependencies could be weaker. They were modelled using things like iterative proportional fitting. Today's techniques, starting with people like Paul Williamson, who's now at Liverpool, with Phil Reeson, so I'm Mark Birkin, was to change that and to try and reweight survey data. Starting maybe with a sample of anonymised records, which is available from the census, that 2 or 3% sample of households. That's got all the interdependencies there, but what it doesn't give you is the geography. So what you try to do is match the criteria in each of those records as best you can to say, okay, this first record in this sample is an old man, 78 years of old age, on his own, obviously retired, no car. And then you'd say, okay, from the census, where is that household most likely to be? So you're reweighting survey data, and effectively cloning each individual that you see in a survey and saying, where is that person most likely to live? Or think of it the other way. Think of a house in a particular part of Edinburgh. How does that household characteristics most fit a household that appears in the survey? And therefore you try and match it. So from the sample of anonymised records, you can expand out to all sorts of different surveys. Health Survey of England is one we've used, which has a lot of characteristics of the person themselves and then their illnesses and so on. And again, you try and reweight that. Where are those types of people? Are they on the council estates, etc.? And then you take that kind of behaviour with you. So it's lots of new methods for doing that, optimization, genetic algorithms, etc. And what that does is gives you very strong interdependencies because they're in the surveys themselves. It can create some problems with the geography. because you're trying to fit those households, clone them to different parts of the city. And I'll come back to that later on. But in effect, we're trying to clone the surveys. So the outputs, in a sense, are a mixture of things. This is Sim Leeds. This is the first one with Dimitri Ballas. Some of you will know Dimitris, who did his PhD at Leeds, to build Sim Leeds. And so it really becomes a little bit like this list of variables goes on, about 50 variables. It becomes a bit like a pick and mix of Woolworths, if you remember pick and mix of Woolworths, where you used to go in and say, I want a bit of this, a bit of that. So you might want to say, I want to know, tell me all the people who are 20 to 25, male, married, council house, got a job in shipbuilding, professional managerial. And it would, so you interrogate the database like that to try and get that distribution of people and where you think they are in the city. So that then you can have other survey data. So given that we know so much about them, we can probably estimate their income. Given we know their age, the occupation, the industry that they're in. If they're unemployed and we know the family structure, so we know they've got kids or whatever, we can work out income from transfer payments. So for the first time you get small area estimates of people getting housing benefit or whatever, which will come apparent in a minute. And also wealth, taxation, etc. And then start to link it to with things like spatial interaction models to say, okay, where are those households most now likely to be employed? So journey to work, to shop, schools, health centres and leisure. And as you build this up, some of you may come across agent-based modelling. Which again, somewhere like UCL in London is particularly strong. You start to get close to agent-based. The agents in those models are obviously individuals, and here you're adding at the end, you're adding some kind of behaviour to those agents as well as just attributes of what they look like. And that gets close to that kind of work as well. So I think agent-based and micro-simulation isn't too far apart, although the agent-based modellers will disagree and say it's much more clever than that. So, just some outputs of that kind of thing. So this is a Leeds map, see a few of these as we go through. And this is the kind of way of just interrogating the database. So obviously this is the kind of thing you can't get from the published census. Okay, you can't get a table which asks you for, in this case, Black Caribbean males, aged between 16 and 29, living in rented accommodation. And this is the distribution of those households as simulated in Sim Leeds. Okay, we've got a picture there in North Leeds where a lot of the Caribbean population kind of lives. So that ability, I think, just to create your own data set from it, your own different tabulations, is very powerful in terms of social science. Again, the question is, you're asking all the way through this, is how accurate are these simulations then? I say one of the things you always want to do is to check that if you sum up any of these kind of columns, you get to the known census totals. Okay, so you know you've got the right number of black population, Caribbean, you know you've got the right 16 to 29, you know you've got the right rented accommodation. You hope, therefore, you've got the right interdependencies between that. And notice the word hope there, because it's missing data. The only way you can actually prove it is to do surveys or to get the original census data. So in one sense, there's always a bit of a risk in that. At least it's an estimation of where this kind of group might live. And this is an old map now. These are the GIS maps that have moved on in the last 10 years or so from Sim Leeds. The first kind of maps really showing small area geographies of income estimation. Again, they're still in 2011. There won't be a question on income in the census, I think, anyway. It's still being left out. So again, we're still going to be simulating income from various sources. So again, this is the first distribution in Leeds. Again, North Leeds quite affluent, South Leeds not so affluent. So again, matches all expectations of what we know of the city. And spatial distribution of average income tax, etc. So producing distributions have not been seen before at the small area level in particular. So I think the advantage, just at the start with, of this kind of technique then, first of all, you're making the best use of survey data. Now, clearly, the more records you've got in the survey, the bigger the survey, the better. because the more records you've got in a survey, the more you can try and clone them, in a sense, the more you can try and find different types of person in those surveys and fit them to the different localities. But if you have got survey data, like the Health Survey of England and so on, the British Household Panel Survey, some of you may have come across that. Again, very rich attribute list. What we're trying to do is to add some geography to say where are those people most likely to live. So it really increases the richness of survey data by adding the spatial component. Brilliant with data linkage, because once you've got two or three attributes in this, you can then link across maybe many survey data. Because you've got two or three variables in common, then you can try and fix on those. We call those the constraint variables, the variables that you try and match on specifically. And the more matching variables there are in each survey, the richer you are and the better simulation you will get. The spatial flexibility is great because you're doing this for individuals or households, so you can aggregate up to any spatial scale. So if the planners in the room here, or the Scottish Government, who might be reporting data at ward level or at parliamentary level or something else, then you can easily aggregate to those spatial scales and not have some of the problems you have with more meso-level data. And then the what-ifs. So once I've simulated this, then obviously I can change those household structures. What happens if income falls by 10%? What happens if unemployment grows? And I'll show you some examples of this. So the power then to do the what-ifs is quite high. If you look at microsimulation work in economics, again, it goes back way into the 1950s, a guy called Guy Alcott, who sort of started microsimulation. And there are some very big national microsimulation models that are used by governments, certainly English governments, for tax purposes. People like Holly Sutherland and her groups have got these massive microsimulation databases, but they don't have any space in them. So they just take every person, wherever they are in the UK, and do simulations on them. And they're often the bedrock of these kinds of things. So every time we have a budget, the Chancellor comes along and says, okay, I'm going to take, you know, £2.50 off family allowance. I'm going to do this, this, and this. Then you get these kinds of things that appear in the paper. So here's a typical old couple and what it might mean to that old couple. Well, that's fine. But, of course, what we're interested in as geographers, and urban geographers in particular, is when you make those changes, what actually happens to individuals and what happens to individual locations? So how is it going to affect... I'm going to struggle now, we don't know any places in Edinburgh, so I have to use Leeds. How's it going to affect different parts of Leeds the most? So just to show you that kind of output, I'm just going to draw on a fairly big survey that was done with Joseph Rowntree in the mid-2000s with Danny Dorling, some of you will know Danny from Sheffield, where we had a big microsimulation model built for the UK. Basically what we wanted to do was simulate all sorts of government changes. And you'll see how relevant this is going to be in a second to today. What we did was just classify, just for simplicity on these slides, we just classified households into these classifications. Obviously, in the real model, there is actually every single individual income group. But I've just aggregated them here for demonstration. So we split the population into the very poor, below 50% median income, the poor, below average, affluent, etc. Let's say all the other groups are there. Includes all earned income, and all benefits that those households would get. Once we did that, we did some scenario, looking into the future, crystal ball and gazing, if you like. We said, what might Britain look like in, say, 2010, 2015, actually went all the way up to 2025 in the Sim Britain project, if the kind of current trends continue. So mass simulation, and we chose York as an illustration because of Joseph Rowntree's headquarters. We chose York as a particular case study and presented most of the material on York. And you can download SimBrit from Rowntree's website, I think, now. Then you get the sort of trends that you might expect to see. Increased number of households, a large increase in single households, both at the younger end and at the older end as people become widowed, divorced. A decline in unemployment, this is before the recession, of course, increase in unskilled jobs, a decline in ill health and an increase in elderly with disabilities, increase in adults with no qualification, increase in loneliness from that. Luigi Bowles went on to do a whole study on the geography of happiness, which again some of you may have seen, looking at various indicators, and an increase in the very poor. So that's the polarisation, and Danny Dorling, of course, has talked all his life about the growing inequalities in British society over the last 20 years, and all this in Britain showed that this is just going to get worse and worse and worse. But of course, that's the long-term trend. What you can also simulate is, what we did was simulate the last, or one of the last anyway, of Tony Blair's, his government's changes to the welfare state. So they changed the working family tax credit, they introduced the minimum wage, a minimum income guarantee, extra winter fuel payments for the elderly and free TV licence. So we simulate all those rule changes into the model and just say now, instead of looking at Victor Meldrew there and the kind of thing for the whole country, how is this going to affect every household, say, in Edinburgh, or wherever you're from, Belfast or Leeds, okay? And that's what we did with Britain. We looked at York. So these are just for York here. You could start to see that Labour government, this has not been bringing any politics into it, by the way, but that last Labour government was quite a good redistributive budget. Income for the very poor up nearly 20%. Again, poor income was up. Families with children were benefiting very much so. And of course, that's changed recently. 246 families in York enjoyed a 50% increase in their income tied to those benefits. And 3,000 households in York changed from the category of very poor to poor. So you could begin to see, and obviously you can break that down in the full report by different regions of York, so you could see how the city was changing and the impacts of that. What we're just going to start to do now with Leeds City Council is simulate all the welfare changes that have just been made in the last budget. So Nick Clegg and Co. All those changes, we're now going to simulate, see what it means to Leeds. And of course, the worry is the cumulative impact of those changes are going to be dramatic in certain parts of the city. So we're just doing those simulations now. We just employed someone to start that. And so that's going to be nice, bringing it up to date from the work in the 2000s.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
But you're saying these will be changed by 2021. You mean from the present to that horizon, or from the origin of the...
No, from the present now, yes. Yeah. So
from the present to that horizon.
Yeah, that's okay, because this was the impact of these welfare changes.
When you said impact, I was thinking perhaps back.
Yeah, the first one was from 1991, just trending things forward, but this was then bringing in the changes. So, social-based policy. So I think we can say a lot about the impacts of that in terms of urban deprivation. The next one is area-based policy. Because again, you know, should we be pumping hundreds of thousands of pounds into areas, or should we be pumping them into sort of people through tax changes? So we've also used this for looking at the impacts of major investments and divestments. Now, again, without getting into too much detail, I don't know how much you know, but I also come from a background called regional science, which is a lot of economists using econometric methods. And the input-output model is one of their biggest sort of or most used tools. So they look at, say, what happens if in Edinburgh tomorrow 2,000 jobs are created in a certain sector. That's the input. Then they look at the outputs. So what will be the multiplier effects of that? So how many jobs will be created, therefore, in leisure industry, services, and so on. Trouble with those input-output models, they're very coarse spatial scales. They can't do it at a very small level. So you tend to get, and the guys from the Scottish Regional Authority might have this big Scottish input-output models. I don't know if you've come across these. These Strathclyde people, Pete McGregor and Kim Swales, you know, they spent their lives building these Scottish input-output tables. But very rarely do they get below the scale of the whole nation. But what we wanted to do is say, okay, the impact of that change in Edinburgh is going to probably affect large parts of Scotland. But how much will it really affect Glasgow, Aberdeen, Inverness? Yeah? And even if you had a regional model, so if it was built on the east side of Edinburgh, how much would it actually affect the west side of Edinburgh? And we'd probably argue not very much. So actually these input-output models and these regional multiplier effects, what meaning can you give them at that such a broad spatial scale? So what we use simply is to say, okay, let's look much more closely at a factory closure in this case. So it's the opposite effect, obviously input's going in less, but it's still the same
what is the knock-on effects, and also look at some island, rural island, southern island, I'm afraid. But so, input-output models is what I've just said, really. At best, the ones that I've seen are at the whole city-wide scale. So Peter Beatty, Moss Madden, Liverpool Civic Design have done some nice city work. Jeff Ewings has done some nice city work in Chicago and in the States. But very little below that. And even those city-wide ones are looked at with great skepticism by many of the economists. You know, why do you want to go down to the city level to do this? So there's a bit of tension there in the air. So what we're trying to do is to say, okay, can we marry some of this macro stuff normally with a bit more micro stuff? So the factory we're going to simulate closing is here in Seacroft, in East Leeds. It was a factory that has actually closed now. It's a factory that produced tanks, as in army tanks. So that was closed about 5 years ago. So an input-output model, let's say, would say, okay, let's take the 1,000 jobs in mechanical engineering, let's take them out of the system. How many jobs are then going to be lost, and knock-on effects? In probably the spatial scale would be Yorkshire, you know, which includes Bradford, Sheffield, Hull, because there's nothing below, certainly the regional scale for Yorkshire, how many jobs are going to be lost in other sectors. So what we say, what can we do better than that, surely? Because we can say, well, first of all, who works there? So we know the 1,000 or so workers, we know what kind of workers they were, professional, managerial, skilled, non-manual, etc. So we can link this to SimLeads with all our micro database on all the different households, and we can do that through simple journey to work model. So now if you look at it, that's the catchment area, if you like, of this factory. That's the direct catchment area. These are people who actually work in this region. So clearly, when we have loss of this factory, as I said before, East Leeds is going to have a high impact. West Leeds, not so bad. The people here coming across are generally professional managerial over here. So we're going to look at the impacts much more locally than input-output models could ever do. So the first thing we do is, for those 1,000 people that were employed in SimLeads at that particular location, we now change them. They become unemployed in the model. Simple switch. They've lost their jobs. From that, then, all the multiplier effects can knock on, so we can then say, okay, what is the total income loss in the regions around this plant? This is Seacroft and Winmore. Already a very deprived estate in East Leeds, one of these estates that was planned at the edge of the city. And you can start to see these are the ED blocks, enumeration district blocks, calculation of all the income lost in those areas. So you can see how local that is, and obviously you can do that for the whole of Leeds, but there's a strong distance to K as you go from there. And then we started to simulate perhaps the knock-on effects of that. So we then wanted to say, okay, how far can we go here? Well, those people now are spending less money. They're spending less money on different retail goods, particular food and drink. So this is the percentage decline in expenditure, given that these people now have lost their incomes. And therefore, we can start to simulate the loss of revenue in the areas of the local shops, in particular the big retailers. So these are the loss of revenue per week at each of these stores. And then start to say, okay, possibly that we go to a threshold where they're no longer sustainable, so you start to see those jobs closing. So again, the next order effect, we can model and simulate that, and so on, until there's some kind of equilibrium, a change in the area. We also timed it, because one of the things input-output's good is the inter-industry links, which we really haven't got in here. But we knew that there was a factory plant here, which was providing components to that, and that is downsized considerably, so we simulated that downsize. So this is our total estimate of the income lost with the plant closure in this part of East Leeds. And I think that's a nice antidote to the sort of regional multiplier effects. But clearly, once you get away from that, the impacts really in the rest of the region are actually very, very small. And so these regional multiplier impacts, 1.2, 1.3, says something, but I don't really think it tells you too much about the local labour markets affected in these cases. So you're clearly dominated around there, and then other parts associated with these other plants. Similarly, another quick example, interested in work we did with TAGUS, which is the Irish Rural Development Board, based in Dublin it was, it's now near Galway. And they were interested in the simple kind of use of this model. Again, input-output models might typically be used to say, let's take the Community Agricultural Policy, CAP, always being reformed, okay, the latest iteration of that. In about the 2005 area, there was a complete change in the CAP. This was then going to reward people for producing based on historic volumes, basically. So you didn't have to produce anything now under CAP. Provided you produce something historically, you'd still get those historical payments. And so a lot of farmers are moving away from production to actually just managing the landscape. So, in addition to that, the Irish government had got this spatial strategy, the National Spatial Strategy, where it had identified problem areas and it had identified areas which were really expanding and go-getting areas. So the question was, how would the CAP reforms impact onto the National Spatial Strategy? And of course what happens is bad news. Because what we work out from the CAP reforms, and it's good working with an agricultural group like TAGUS who knew the implications of this better than the geographers, that they were picking groups like this, dairy farmers under 45, who were really going to basically prosper under CAP reforms. I won't go into the whys and wherefores of that. But basically that's a young group who could change and diversify and who the historic payment system suited the most. So where were they? Well, this is the distribution of these people here, largely in the south and southeast, as you can see. Okay? Now, if you map unemployment against that, and the circles here are four areas that are identified by the National Spatial Strategy as growing areas. So actually what these CAP reforms show, actually the four areas that are already fantastically prospering in Ireland at this time are going to do even better because those farmers are going to get more income from CAP. So it's unlikely to change that strategy, it's just going to reinforce it. Unfortunately, the group that was suffering most were the calf farmers in Ireland, and especially the elderly calf farmers in Ireland. And if you look at their pattern, it's very different up in the north and the northwest. So those are the farmers and the farm regions that were going to suffer the most from the lack of income from CAP. And of course, they are right in the centre of the two most areas, the two most deprived, two most, I think they call them weak in the NSS strategy. And so this was bad news for the National Spatial Strategy because the two areas they've identified as being the biggest problem are just going to get worse with those developments in CAP. So that's a simulation, and you said, well, how does that make to micro-simulation? This was a simulation, I should have said, of every farm in Ireland, so just of individuals or houses. These were every farms that we simulated those details. So finally, let me just take you into, for examples, just take you into one or two areas, certainly Jamie will be more familiar with. Looking at health, and again, trying to take surveys and then clone them to say, okay, if we know the types of people who are have these sorts of illnesses from things like the Health Survey of England, various other ones, then can we clone those households and see where we think the distributions might be? So obesity. So what kind of individuals in the Health Survey of England seem to be coming out as obese? What kind of individuals in the Health Survey of England have got type 2 diabetes? Which kind of households smoke? Smoke on a regular basis, and an example here I show you that also have depression, one element of mental health. So we've done some work on all four of those. We're also doing some work now on the relationship between obesity and fast food outlets. Kind of thing Jamie's actually done quite a lot of work himself, hospitalisation rates and so on. So the first sort of simulation then is simulating what we think obesity is in Leeds.
Okay, so this is not real data, this is simulated data. And these are the 33 wards in Leeds, so the spatial scale is quite broad. And as you can, this sort of is what we might have expected. If you think obesity has a strongest link to deprivation, then the most deprived areas of Leeds, which are the south and the east, which is sort of this corridor and this corridor, tend to be coming out as areas where we're predicting the highest levels of obesity to be. But of course, when you simulate the Health Survey of England, what you do realise is, of course, that there are plenty of more wealthy households which are obese, for various reasons. And so it's not just a deprivation-driven activity. So there are wealthy households. So if you break this, and of course you can see some of that, hidden at that spatial scale. So if we drop down into the superapprobate areas, then you can see a slightly different pattern. Yes, we're picking up that deprivation here in the centre and east and south, but now we've got pockets of obesity predicted in much more affluent areas of the city. So whatever, of course, which I think probably health geographers have known for a long time, whatever's driving obesity is not just simply the fact that it's deprivation, poor diet. There are other things going here to do with that. And Kim Edwards, who did this work for her thesis, also ran a geographically weighted regression to see if she could then try and ascertain maybe some, this is always quite difficult to do, but some explanatory variables in different areas. Possibly again driven that in certain parts maybe supermarkets difficult to access seems to be an important driver. In other words, people are living quite some distance from major supermarkets, which might give you a decent access to a decent diet for a decent price. Perhaps sedentary children picking up here in the more affluent areas, kids who are not spending too much time on their computers and iPhones and so on, and maybe again access to fruit and veg in certain areas. At least trying to suggest that there could be a variety of things at risk. What we also what we could get is school data. Of course, data on obesity, there is much more of it available for school kids. So we can plot all the schools, so all the points, all the dots of the major schools in Leeds against deprivation, and also against, which is not mapped on here, is our estimates of what we think obesity is like in those areas. And this is a map that we're now taking on to do some more work on. It's almost like a traffic light signals. So we're interested in sort of the red dots, where we've got hotspots of obesity in schools, which seem to be in areas we would not predict that. So they seem to be perhaps in affluent areas or something else. So why is obesity so high in that school when we wouldn't predict it? So it's almost like the outliers of the model. Similarly, the greens are the coldest, the blues are the coldest spots here. So again, areas of obesity. I think that should be pointing to the green dots actually. Anyway. Areas where obesity seems to be very low in those schools, but we would perhaps expect it in a deprived area to be much higher. So I've got a new PhD student who's going to do a similar simulation in West Lancashire, and then is going to go into, hopefully, a variety of these red and green dot schools to see if you can see what's actually going on a more qualitative basis about what's happening. Is it the school environment? Is it the residential environment? Just noticing time, so I'll try and speak up a little bit. And finally, depression. Again, linking it to spatial interaction model. So we're in the Irish microsimulation model, we've now tried to simulate depression. Okay? This is not it. Oh, this is not it. At the moment, this is not it. this is just simply access to psychiatric hospitals. So the red dots are the hospitals, and as you probably expect in Republic of Ireland, many of them are concentrated in the Dublin region. And this is just an accessibility service, really. So, of course, you're worried about, in anything with rural sort of health provisions, you're worried about what's going on in these areas here. And if you just sort of focus on the north, remember we've already suffered with the calf farmers, if you look at that now, our simulation of depression from the Irish health surveys shows that kind of picture. Very high types of rural households showing signs of depression in the north and the northwest.
Again, if you go back to that, perhaps with almost the poorest level of provision. And again, it's a classic health issue, isn't it? You know, what causes that? Is it the supply side problem? Are the hospitals not in the right locations? And how would you ever solve that unless you had mobile kind of facilities? Is there a lot of unreporting of depression that people in villages don't want to their doctor to know about that, because if the doctor knows, everybody else in the village will know, and so on. So there's really interesting issues about health provision against something like mental health here in Ireland. And finally, just smoking on health, which again I think is a very nice illustration of the ability of microsimulation to get multivariables involved. If you were trying to estimate smoking in Edinburgh tomorrow, how would you go about it, or in Belfast, or wherever? Well, you might say, the first thing I can do is do it by age. So I know younger people generally smoke more than elderly people. That's across all social groups. So if I just plotted it by age, I get this distribution in Leeds. Unsurprisingly, quite a lot around the university, where most young people are. And you might say, okay, that's one way. I could also do it by social class. I know that social class D's and E's, lower income, smoke more. So if I did it by social class, I get a different map. Okay? So now the youngest people are not so much in the northwest. It's now, again, that south and east corridors that I've been worried about all the way through the talk. They now come out as being the areas with the highest number of smokers. So which map is correct? Okay? I could do it by ethnicity, because this is not a very good map, in a sense, because it's doesn't really show you what's really going on in this map here, but that the highest smokers in ethnicity, of course, are sort of male Chinese, male Bangladesh, those kinds of groups. So that would be another one plotted. So what my simulation do is really take three maps, almost like a GIS overlay, and say, okay, I'm going to try and estimate smoking on age, social class, and ethnicity. And if I do that, that's my final map. Work from Mel Tomlin. Sorry, she's broken all the GIS rules with a horrible mixed colour map here. But you can see the reds now. And that final map is a mixture of the age groups and social class. You can actually see all those parameters beginning to work out. So microsimulation then helpfully using, it's missing data. You know, we don't have data on individual smoking. So at least it's a best attempt. We've now worked with Leeds Public Health Authority to start using location allocation models. just for the audience. You see, I know my audience. And to say to them, you know, simply, based on that distribution, where are the current stop smoking clinics in Leeds? Because they've set up a number of clinics where they are. And of course, we can look at the models, where the model wants to put them, and we've worked with them to slowly change that distribution of where the smoking clinics actually were. When you actually talk to the health authority, this sounds terribly rude, when you talked about them, they'd really just put them anywhere. You know, you got to the bottom line, just sort of scatter them about around a bit. But now at least they've not sort of scattered them around quite enough, as you can see. So hopefully we're able to produce them in better areas. And of course then it's interesting to what health policy you want. You can simulate the heavy smokers, those who smoke more than 20 a day, if you really want to target them, or the light smokers. So again, here's the best locations for about 8 or 9 service points for the heavy smokers. And there's location models, clearly they want to, if you've never seen these before, they want to locate in the centre of the spider plots, basically. And then this is a sort of the catchment area of each of those centres. One last retail example, and then only 5 minutes left. A retail example, some nice work we did with some Japanese colleagues who had a survey, and this is typical kind of use of microsimulation. They've done a survey of retailing in a city in Japan, in Kyoto. Of course, it was only a survey, and they'd broken it down by those 6 groups. And basically, it didn't really match the census. You got the Japanese census, it doesn't have these kinds of 6 groups. So what we can do with the microsimulation is simulate those groups, and then clone that survey, if you like, to say, okay, the shopping behaviour from this survey, where are the younger single, older single, and we'll attach that shopping behaviour to all those groups across the city of Kyoto. Now you can see these are my maps made by my Japanese colleagues, which are far better than my GIS skills. And so we're simulating now the whole of the... Remember, these aren't available from census data sets. We have to make those from picking out younger elements, single elements, and so on. And you can see where we think the younger singles live, where we think the older families live. And then we put that into... There's a nice equation for you, just to drive you to the pub. There's a spatial interaction model where the demand is now fed in from that micro-simulation, bringing those different retail groups in, and then we're able to simulate what happens if you build a new shopping centre, what kind of groups are going to go to that centre, and so on. Finally, just a few slides on the research agenda, because as you're going through there, the drawbacks of all this. What I say, it's hard to calibrate because many of the model outputs, we, like the smokers, you know, how do we calibrate that unless you go out and ask every person where they smoke? So sometimes the best we can do is hold our hands up and say, this is our best estimate of where we think these groups are. When you're merging surveys, clearly you're picking certain variables to match on. Age, sex, social class, etc. They're called the constraint variables. Those should be reproduced really well because you're actually asking the mathematical program to match on those categories. The other ones are less likely to be matched well, okay? Because you're not matching on those, so they could be simulated a bit more poorer. And this is something we've come on to notice a little bit more. You think of a survey. Now, if you asked 2,000 people in Edinburgh tomorrow a survey on certain activities, it's quite likely you'll miss the extremes. You might not get to the very wealthy, who might not be wandering along Princes Street, or the very poor. And that's sort of apparently more in sort of social survey. Even if you do it by actually visiting people's houses, then who in the right mind are going to go around some of the estates, especially with health and safety. So are you going to deliberately pick middle kind of class households to go around? So you do see when you're trying to match that you don't get a huge number of the really extreme households, the very, very wealthy and the very, very poor. Plus the fact that sometimes in the surveys, because there's no geography, they might miss actually some real geography going on. So very quickly, Mel Tomlins was trying to simulate births. So based on age, sex, social class, ethnicity, for the wards in Leeds. And our model worked really well, except in the most deprived areas, where from cloning the Health Survey of England, in terms of people giving births, you're underestimating the number that come from the most deprived estates in Leeds. And when you've got the actual data, because this is a rare example where we can get actual data on births from the Health Authority, you can see that we were predicting it really based on just a few of the wards, but you have to trust me, the rest were as good as the top three, but in the most deprived, we were under, in those council estates, young kids were having much more kids than we probably would have expected, just because there weren't enough of that type of household in the survey. So we had to put an extra weight in, an extra deprivation weight, if you like, to get that right. And I love this one, of course. This is where micro-simulation can go really wrong, students. So it predicted in Headingley, where all the students live, 880 births. What we really saw is 100, because not many students actually have a child whilst they're at university. So, of course, the model doesn't know that, because it sees 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old girls, loads of them, and it wants to give them all babies. So, I'm slightly over-predicting 778 too many babies in Headingley. So, of course, we've got to rectify for that. We've got to put some student factor, fudge factor in there, perhaps, for that. Fortunately, it's only one zone, but nice to be honest occasionally. Work with Diane Smith that we've written up recent environment planning A, where what we try to do is say, okay, rather than have the same constraints matched on across the whole city, like Edinburgh, let's split, say, Edinburgh into five different locations and use different constraints to regenerate the population. So in certain areas, deprivation might be important, others affluence, ethnicity, etc. So that they become the most important, because you know that they're the most important variables in that particular region or where you would start from. And that improved some of the fits in Leeds really quite nicely. And then finally, adding geodemographics, which again not talked about much, but I think you know, most of you will know geodemographics like the ACORN classifications. can we add that? And the example I use here is I'm just trying to simulate car ownership. Now, you think that quite straightforward. Again, you can simulate household panel surveys with number of cars and so on. And, of course, we know from the data we can get, from the census we can get, it's against what we can test. But when we're simulating it just based on age, social class, etc., then what we do, we find an interesting problem with car ownership. The model is over-predicting car ownership close to the city centre and under-predicting it in the suburbs, just based on age, sex, social class, etc. Because again, in that survey, there's no geography to tell me where that house is in relation to, say, city centre. So of course, people close to the city centre might not own a car. They can walk to work or they can get the bus. Those in the suburbs have to have it, almost. So you can see how we were under and over-predicting. So the absolute error was quite high for a variable like car ownership, which you think must be quite simple to simulate. And actually, geography distorts it, because it's not just based on age, sex, social class, ethnicity, or whatever. Something else is driving it. The joke there, you could laugh if you like, so that's a joke. What we thought, we were able to get some Axiom data, which is a fantastic database now that we're beginning to work in partnership with Axiom, who've got this massive survey data. They reckon they've got half the population on the survey. And so we can add to a geodemographic classification, because again, sorry, if you just look at where we're sort of, as I say, under-predicting in the prosperous suburbs. This is the ONS classification in England, and I think it's England and Wales, and over-predicting in constrained by circumstances. If you can add a geographic classifier to the micro simulation, when you then do the clustering, you get a much better fit. And the error comes down to 20, from 25 to just 11%. So the model performed much better, except again, we're just over-predicting constrained by certainties for some reason. That's just needs still a bit of work on multicultural too. But a much better fit. So if only the surveys, if people who were making the surveys could, whilst they had that individual address, could attach a label to it, a geodemographic label, that wouldn't spread any confidentiality problems, but it would allow the geographer to be much, to do a lot more work with it, if we can persuade those survey people to do that. Maybe we can't, but they're okay. Phew, sorry. So, a broad sweep through applications. As I say, you'll make up your own mind whether those examples are useful or not. But I think it's, as I say, we found it useful for trying to do things like missing data. The smoking is probably one of the best examples, the simplest examples there. But once you've got that, say, so looking at the spatial implications of policy change, I think is one of the most exciting parts of the research agenda. And also, I think you can add it to through the spatial interaction models, journey to works, journey to shop. You've seen examples of adding it to the GWR, where we're trying to then look at the patterns and so on. And what we're trying to do now, this is Scottish, I'm glad to look here because in May, we're going to Strathclyde having a two-day workshop on whether we can actually link a macro input-output modelling more formally to the micro-simulation and start to do something much more meaningful from the Scottish regional input-output tables and say, well, what does that actually mean in different parts of Glasgow, different parts of Edinburgh and so on. And I hope that will be another powerful research agenda. So sorry, I've gone a little bit more. Sorry. Thanks.
Okay, thanks to Graham. Right, where do we start? Burning questions.
Just from a Northern Ireland perspective, the online should help her form stuff that you're running.
Yeah.
And maybe just could we get a bit more information on it now, but at some stage.
Sure.
We work in the Department of Social Development.
Right.
We're NISRA statisticians, rather than statistics research statisticians. So we produce the benefit statistics for Northern Ireland, so we have the individual data.
Yeah.
We would have access then to the census variables, obviously, as well, and SARS and all the other stuff. So part of it is all there. I think we'd be able to do something if we just had the
Queen's City Council, because again, we want to do that with them, because they've also got the great, you know, data on the benefits as well. So I can send you those as well. And yeah, if there's an interest there, please let us know, because you know, it might be whilst we're simulating for Leeds, we can simulate, you know, for Belfast. We've hired somebody already, so you know, it might not be that such a difficult thing. You know, once we've cracked it for Leeds, in a sense, to do the same. So if you send me an email or something after,
yeah,
then
sure. Will do.
I'll leave these slides on the thing, so it's got my email on the front. So please do; it'd be great.
Can you send me a copy of the slides as well? If I email you.
Yeah, sure. And I say I'll send you the papers on the social policy bit as well, so you can just get a bit more background. If anybody wants to read the more technical stuff on the model, then they'll be in those papers too. Okay, thanks for coming over.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the slides will be on the website and the audio too. I'll pass it up very shortly, so that's a start for that. Glad to be facilitating. Just hope you can come back and solve some of Edinburgh's problems. Say the tram thing. But, right, so can we squeeze in a few more questions? Jamie?
Great, thanks. That's great. I can get a really quick overview of what's a really complex topic, but also a really valuable one. So many aspects of social science research have been shown. I want to return you to the issue around this verification of results. So that's a really interesting one. I just wonder if you might be able to comment on how this type of approach compares to perhaps other ways of achieving some similar sorts of outcomes. So taking your example of smoking, which is really one I found particularly interesting. When we all went through a similar exercise, we used a synthetic approach using multi-level modeling, applying parameters, and I can see some sort of strengths and weaknesses of, I guess, both approaches. The multi-level approach can take into some extent can account for local geography rather than using universal parameters. I just wonder if you could sort of talk to that and sort of how what the advantages of alternative approaches might be.
It's a great question. And there's also a way of coming at it from if you look at statistical data estimation techniques, people like Rauer and so on, they've used other kinds of ways, you know, almost like complex regression models to come up with the same thing, almost trying to be built at local, you know, local levels. So there is a variety of different methodologies. And the answer, I think, is that what we desperately need is someone to take a data set and to do all these different methods on. I thought I'd got someone to do that, but then she said, no, I want to do something a bit more interesting. Because it does sound, you know, unless you're really good at analytical techniques. But I think it's desperately needed to be done to say, okay, let's take the same data set and try three or four different kinds of techniques, like multi-level modeling, like these kind of regression techniques, microsimulation. So whenever I send a paper off on microsimulation, it comes back from the referee, why have you not looked at multi-level modelling, or can you explain the difference? So it's buzzing around, I think, the community all the time. I think it would be really nice to take something and say, okay, these are different ways, strengths and weaknesses of these. What's the how similar is the output? What's the differences? Why? And I think that would be a really useful research project. So I agree with you entirely, and I say I can't really say much because it's, you know, you do tend to stick rather like, you know, when spatial interaction models, they go across audiences all the time and say, why don't you use a logit model or a discrete choice model? And you have the same kinds of battles. Well, this is what I was brought up with, it was my technique. Why am I going to use that? But they are doing similar, you know, they're doing similar kinds of flow models, just one's more individual. So I think, whilst there has been a bit of discussion of those sort of alternative approaches like Harry Timmons and some, I don't think there has at this small area level. So I think it's a really good question and a really good piece of work that's waiting to be done. Especially with someone like Miles Gould in my department, who's, you know, pretty good at multi-level models. We should really try and get that underway. Maybe. So, yeah, good question.
Yeah,
well.
Cool.
That was, I don't know what the maximum superlative is in Yorkshire. But I mean for me that was exciting, stimulating, absolutely terrific, very nicely presented. And in Scotland, in the Scottish context, I would even go as far as saying it was awfully good. That's the maximum you'll get in Scotland.
Thank you very much.
So what is it in Yorkshire?
Not mine.
I'll read, probably. I'll read.
Okay. But there's lots of things I'd love to ask you about. But it's exciting to see location allocation models being used. I've been retired for years, and since then I've mostly been involved with Polish geography and history, and that's even more complicated than location allocation models.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But could you say, I mean, there's location allocation models, there's a whole family of them,
yeah.
Different objectives,
yeah.
Different
yeah.
Assumptions.
Yeah.
Could you say a wee bit about which particular ones you used and so on?
In this case, actually, it was a PhD student. She actually used quite a large variety of them. Actually, now, most of you are ARC users. That's part of ARC, in
yeah.
Our plot location immersion, is actually quite powerful
yeah.
For trying. So when I say lots of them, it was within the sort of ARC. It wasn't specialist software, so she used ArcGIS.
Okay.
So you know, she started with a simple one, mid distance and so on. But
did she use any with a spatially elastic demand, where you assume that demand will fall off, will actually fall off at distance?
No.
Because I don't think, last I remember, before you used Google,
yeah.
ARC, the ARC models, didn't have that.
No, I don't think they do, yeah. I think, well, to be honest, most of her work was about the smoking estimation.
Okay.
But when it came to the policy bit, then the question was, in the okay, well, what's the, you know, do I then just put them in red? So the last part of the answer is, well, actually, if you just look at location, it'll allocate based on the maximum demand, or based on that demand pattern. So it just gives you an immediate. That's a nice thing about location allocation.
Yeah.
And it just gives you an immediate sort of visual impact of where the centre should be. But then she had a lot of scenarios to say about. She even tried putting them using the set of dentists as a possible fixed set of points, because in Leeds, again, there's talk about the stop smoking clinics actually being attached to dentists and then taking that role, because I suppose on the basis that they see people more regularly and see people's problems with smoking, how it affects the teeth and so on. Anyway, that was the... So one of the location allocations was to have the choice set actually fixed locations of all the dentists, so again, it shows only the dentist locations, and then that is usually just one. So I think that part of it was probably quite simple, Bob, in terms of the variety of suites of location models you could actually use.
There used to be this kind of situation that some people did spatial interaction models and some people did location allocation models.
Yeah.
And they kind of didn't come
together
very much.
No.
The basic location allocation models were always for a long while assuming everybody goes to the nearest centre.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Now, but there was an obvious scope to bring them together.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did a wee bit of that myself.
Yeah, that's right.
And didn't get very far. And I just wonder, it looked as if you were doing the basic assumption of everybody goes to the nearest centre.
Yeah.
Rather than using your spatial interaction models to make that a bit more realistic. And I just wondered if you had any, if that is the case, knowing the great wealth of spatial interaction work at Leeds, whether there might be scope to make your location allocation models more realistic.
Possibly. Those are not quite sure. Spatial interaction models sort of do the same thing as location allocation models, but they add some kind of attractiveness, I mean, crudely, to that. So rather than just locate on the minimum distance from the smoking centres to the population, you also have some kind of attractiveness which attracts people to that location. In addition, so like retailers are more attractive to Tesco's than they are to small stores, because the brand and all the size and so on. So, we have to think of how, again, what the attractiveness of different outlets would be. We were just assuming that people would say a stop smoking clinic is a stop smoking clinic. You know, you get those services. But maybe you could do it perhaps by the services offered.
Yeah.
So, for example, if it really is just a leaflet in one centre versus technical advice, you could build some kind of brand attractiveness, you know, some kind of location attractiveness in there.
But you can also, even when all the centres are equally attractive, not everybody's going to go to the nearest centre.
Yes, okay. So
you can still allow, make the centres equally attractive,
yeah.
And still allow some overlap in the catchment.
Yes, that's true.
Using a
distance
kind of spatial choice.
Yeah.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
good points.
Depends how attractive the journey is to each centre. If you're going to Tesco, Dalkeith, or Tesco, Musselburgh, that's one for me to worry about. Colin's got one. I've got one in reserve.
Is there any scope to link accessibility models with public transport access and things like that, and take that into consideration? The ball was talking about, so you take account of not only the attractiveness of the centre, but how easily people can get to that centre on a bus or a train.
Yeah, again, there's nothing in principle to stop you doing that. I mean, we didn't do that in this case, as I say, because it was almost one chapter out of seven or eight, once you've just tried this. If you were starting from now, I guess, then it could be interesting to do the things that Bob has said. But also, as you say, how do you measure distance? And for many people, it's not straight line distance, it's not car distance on the network, it's access to bus routes and things. I suppose if you're looking at just on the location side, you might say, then what about workplaces? Actually the daytime population, where the smokers are, which again would be the next logical thing to say, okay, I've simulated where they live, now where do they work? So where have I got large concentrations during the day? And that could be another way of making those more sophisticated, I think. So as I say, it was only the end part of a product. If it was a starting point, if you were doing it, I think then those would be very interesting, because again, that wasn't an issue raised. Some of the most deprived estates with the highest smoking rates, there was a real accessibility problem for those people to get to wherever they were located. No car, and of course only a fixed resource in terms of how many you can actually have. Can't have them everywhere. So, I think when you get to that level, then I think it could easily take off on its own as a very big project, but an interesting one, I think.
Throw it in.
So a quick watch. Maybe this is the start out of the right, but I suppose if we see it as a way of cloning what the census did collect, but we can't get access to it, I suppose the question in mind is, then the further we get away from the census state, those relationships that we're holding, you might argue that they've already changed. So I know that there are ways that people try to sort of simulate this. But where would we be 5 years post-census and things like that? But they're not using micro-simulation to do these update, these intermediate census estimates, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, that's a great question. That's why, things like using British Household Panel Survey as opposed to the SARS actually gives you a much better contemporary picture in 2010, right, probably, of what Britain does. But it does raise issues of how you calibrate, because all you can do is still total up to the known census data. But you probably, therefore, you could be arguing that your simulation might be better, because why should it now have totaled to the 2001 census area? In many areas, of course, that is remarkably stable at a small area level. But of course, you're right, in certain locations, you might be then sort of thinking, I've got this thing in X here, the census doesn't tell me. Actually, I might be more right just now than the actual census variables. But again, it's what you can use as constraint variables, but if it still has to do with that 2001 census, then that is a problem. It's a problem across all social science, where you're trying to use small area data, and the last one is 2001. But it's interesting, because we've been talking to Axiom. You see, Axiom are a massive, they collect all these surveys that come from things like warranties and so on, these companies are collecting. And they have, we've been looking at the Yorkshire Numberside data. It's a fantastic database, because it's got huge numbers of activities, but it's also got the postcode, the actual 62 postcode of the individual. So you can't say who the individual is, but you can say the postcode's a really fine spatial scale. We're starting to use it now. It's a fantastic database. And we're talking to Axiom to say, look, the 2011 census might be the last one in the UK. So are we going to have to rely more and more on surveys, cloning of surveys, to get some estimates? And I suspect we might. So we're trying to get Axiom to say, look, come on, get more, try and get more, again, this sounds rude and crude, more academic label to your organisation, because it might be the last major source of small area data we have.
Yeah. So the cost, they just estimated the cost of the census, you think that money was used in other ways.
Couldn't they take the people in the sample of anonymised records and do a mini update on them 5 years after the census. Just those 1%, and that wouldn't solve all those problems, but it wouldn't cost that much, and it would give us an idea of the change into change over the 5 intervening years.
Absolutely, I mean, Ireland, I think, still has, they've gone now, but the Southern Ireland has every 5 years, and that's powerful. And again, I'm not sure that like the 2006 one was actually a full census, as you say, but it was certainly some kind of interim step before 2011. So
that's in the Irish Republic.
In the Irish Republic,
What did he do? In the sort of...
I'm not sure, whether it's a full census. I don't think it is, but it's an update for 2006, just like you say, just to get some at least broad trends. I think it's like, it might be for every household, but it's not the full set of variables, so it's just the key variables. Mm-hmm. I know it's not the full set, but at least it's something. But whether that puts the price down, because you've got to ask them anyway, haven't you? I suspect that the price mostly is this processing.
I think so, that's the door.
So less variables to process, maybe.
All right, well, I'm also going to fire a final one, just to, maybe for the benefit of the students. Just basically wondering, so who is using microsimulation? Where is the interest from? You said UCL are big on agent-based modelling. I've had interest from Northern Ireland. Who are the sort of, just a few names?
There are some big centres now around the world. I don't know if you've heard of Paul Waddell, but Paul Waddell... Washington has got huge microsimulation agent-based models, which they use a lot for transport planning, evacuation modelling, that kind of thing. So that's very common. The Netherlands, Peter Hoemeyer, Michael Wegener in Dortmund, big microsimulation centre. NATSEM in Australia, at Canberra, big spatial microsimulation group now. So it's growing slowly. Which is nice to see. And then there are pockets of people. Peter Nijkamp's group is now getting involved, and so on. So it is a small number in terms of academic communities, which again is a little bit surprising because many government agencies actually are big users of it on a national basis. Yeah. As I say, there's some very big microsimulation. But in the United States, CoreSim, which is Steve Caldwell's model, is used a huge amount for US policy tax. Yeah. But again, there's no space in it at all. And I went to see them once as an anecdote here, to tell the difficulty sometimes in persuading the spatial element. I said to them, if you can add space to your models, Steve, for the whole, he said, what a great idea. The next thing, he just randomly put a label next to them where they were, like New York, Belgium. And I said, no, it doesn't quite work like that. Bless them. So even the microsimulation group sometimes have problems with the spatial, because it didn't quite work out. But so it's getting the message across on the spatial side, which I think is interesting. It's interesting for the first time with Kim Edwards with the SIM obesity, he's getting a piece of software which we think is almost generic now, which we haven't ever had before, because it's actually quite hard to get some all the different, telling people how to do the constraints and how to get the service and so on. So I'm hoping people are testing that now, that if that becomes reliable, then at last we can have generic piece of software on the web that people can actually get some data in and actually do the simulations themselves. We've never had that. So fingers crossed, 12 months time maybe there'll be a nice piece of software as well. But again, I think is the only way you can, it's like GWR, you won't do it, will you, unless Chris Brunston and the guys have actually done a nice program for you. I've said that myself, God, how do I program that? So you can't expect it necessarily to actually take off if people can't get access to good software to try it themselves. And if they always have to come to you and say, can you do it, sort of thing. So hopefully that will be a major step forward if we can do that.
That's interesting. Right, well, I think we'll let Graham off the hook there. I think we will reconvene in Brass Monkey. We'll let Graham check into his hotel.
Brass Monkey first, that sounds
good. Brass Monkey.
The hotel will be there when I finish. That's Monkey might not.
Might not. Yeah, we'll never know this time. Right, we will reconvene. So thanks again. Thanks everyone for coming. And thanks to Graham for a very interesting talk.
Thanks for coming.
I have a quick chat with Graham now. I'm going to be an airline.